I think we can now say absolutely fundamentally that the most important aspect of your mental and physical health, your well-being, your longevity is the relationships you create with other people. Because that is sort of tallying alongside quitting smoking, and it's much, much stronger, for example, than maintaining a healthy weight. So it's actually, in a way, the missing health phenomenon. Because we, in the way, we take our relationships for granted. You know, we do all those things which you're told to be healthy, like, you know, drink lots of water, eat the right food, exercise, all those sorts of things. But nobody actually says, do you know what? Just go out and have a lovely cup of tea with a friend.
Well, that is the voice of Anna Machin. She's an evolutionary anthropologist. Love, she says, is integral to our health and happiness. This is the Lizar Wellbeing Show, the podcast helping us all have a better second half. I'm Lizar, and my mission is to find ways for all of us to thrive in later life by investing in our health and our well-being today. Now, did you do anything to mark Valentine's Day just gone, I wonder? I remember the excited anticipation of whether or not I'd received any Valentine's Day cards as a teenager, always miraculously managed to receive at least one, I suspect, sent by my mother, which is probably why I send them to my own kids. Shh, don't tell them. Well, no value judgments here either way. You know, we all express love in our own ways, and I guess we all have our own definitions of what love is, even, to be honest. It's one of those strange things that we all talk about as if we're discussing the same thing, but we'll never really know if we experience it in the same way as anyone else. For me, I guess love is putting someone ahead of myself, or perhaps submitting to losing a little bit of control over how I feel or behave, as love or passion perhaps overtakes rationality and reason. But ultimately, it's about feeling very happy. And in fact, the longest study ever conducted on human happiness recently revealed that our relationships are the key. Anna Machin, who's been researching love in all its forms for 2 decades, has come to a similar conclusion in her book, Why We Love, The Definitive Guide to Our Most Fundamental Need. Need being the crucial word there. Anna also hosts the podcast, How We're Wired, which explores how our brains underpin our experiences, our emotions, and our behaviour. So what is going on in our brains when we love? And how does love affect our physical and mental health?
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Anna, welcome. I'm so looking forward to getting into the nuances of what love actually is and why it's so vital to our health and survival, I guess, as humans.
Excellent. Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, as I mentioned there in the intro, everyone seems to have their own definition of love. What angle do you, as an anthropologist, come at all this from?
It's a tricky question. As an anthropologist, my job is to explain a phenomenon or a behaviour or whatever it might be at every possible level of explanation. So we get a really good handle on what that particular phenomenon is. And when you do it with love, it's incredibly complicated. So what I've had to do over the last 20 years is really try and answer the question, what is love? at every possible level of explanation. So we can answer it at the evolutionary level, where the answer is it's about survival. We can answer it at the genetic level and look at which genes influence how you feel and how you behave when you're in love. We can look at it at the psychological level and look at the concept of attachment, which is what defines our closest relationships. And we can look at it at sort of the social level. So what do our laws say about love? How does our upbringing affect how we love? So it's a really complicated answer to what is actually a very simple question in one sense.
Do you know, I was really struck by your book, actually, which is brilliant on all the different facets. You know, you've just touched on a few there. I love looking at epigenetics, for example, and realising that we can influence our genetic makeup. And, you know, we'll get into kind of some of those epigenetic pathways and, you know, talk about things like dopamine and serotonin, because I thought that was also fascinating. And then, of course, you know, I think on social media, when we look at relationships, we're hearing a lot of those words about attachment, anxious attachment, avoidant, and all of those. So I'd love to, you know, do a deep dive into those as well. Can I just ask you, kind of as an overview, you know, what was it about love as an area of study that kind of captivated you? Was it that it has all these different strands to it and is just such a fundamental thing that perhaps we don't really kind of sit down and analyse too much?
I think so. I think I love a knotty question. I love a question that's going to make my head hurt. So that kind of attracted me in the first place. And I think also I started as a primatologist, actually, before I studied humans. And there, all you're studying actually is relationships, just in a different species. And they're fascinating relationships. It's like a soap opera. And then when I moved on and I joined Oxford and I joined a research group that was looking at the neuroscience of close human relationships, I kind of got given the job of doing those really close ones defined by love. So those between obviously romantic love, but also parental love, friendships, all those sorts of things. And as an anthropologist, it's a fascinating area because it literally infiltrates every fibre of your being. Every biological and psychological mechanism is involved in love, but also every aspect of your daily life. So the decisions you take every day, the rules you live by, everything, if you pare it all the way back and you take it back to where it came from, it comes from love and it comes from the relationships you have. So for an anthropologist, it's absolutely fascinating. You know, love isn't uniquely human. Other animals do experience love. But what we've done to it is we've made it so complex that aspect of love is uniquely human. Therefore, as an anthropologist, I'd be doing a disservice, really, to not study something. I think sometimes it gets belittled as a concept. Oh, it's just love and it's all wishy-washy and, you know, gills like and all that sort of thing. And I think particularly as a female scientist, sometimes I get accused of doing something terribly easy and wishy-washy. But actually, when you really drill down, when you pare everything else away that makes us very complex, all we have is love and all we have is the relationships that we exist within. So for me, it is a fundamental aspect of humanity.
And an integral part of our well-being then, and something that we mustn't overlook, but must look at generating
completely,
more of, perhaps.
Absolutely, completely. And I think we dismiss that too quickly. I think we need to really focus on that health side of it.
You were finishing writing your book during the pandemic, and we've spoken about the ways that COVID, you know, and lockdowns devastated people's lives on the show before. Do you think the conversations around love and human connection became even more imperative during lockdown, and that social connection and the role that it plays in our health perhaps became even more apparent? You know, I'm thinking of, you know, the awful social distancing that everybody had to endure.
I think so. And I think, I did. I wrote it during lockdown. I did a lot of my interviews for the book during lockdown. In a way, it felt even more pertinent to talk to people about the people they loved because they weren't able to be with them in many cases. And I think it made us all realise at a personal level how important those relationships were, because I spoke to a lot of people who said they felt a pain, an emptiness, something that was missing in their lives. Certainly a lot of people struggled with their mental health during lockdown.
And still do.
And a lot of that was because that social connection was not there. And I think hopefully one of maybe the upsides of that lockdown is it made people realise that, again, when everything else has gone away, and life in one sense is very simple and very sort of finite in terms of being shut in your house, the thing you miss the most isn't, you know, going to work necessarily and doing your work or whatever it might be. It's actually, I miss just hugging the people I love. And I think that made people realise that fundamentally what matters is the relationships you're in.
Yeah. I'm really keen to understand the neuroscience here behind love, you know, actually what's going on in our brains, because you write in your book that, I'm quoting here, at its most basic level, love is biological bribery, which I love. You know, what purpose then does our body, our kind of chemical makeup, think that love has for us as a species?
Okay, so yes, very cold, hard, horrible scientific statement there. I must say, just to say, I do think love's much more complex than that. But yes, if we look at the evolutionary purpose of love, it was to aid our survival. So we're a cooperative species and we need to cooperate to survive. So we cooperate to, you know, raise our children. I think if you've had children, you're all aware of the many, many people it involves to raise a human child. We cooperate to learn everything we need to learn, social learning, and we cooperate just for basic subsistence. But the problem is that cooperation is really, really tough. Whilst it has all these positive aspects and we have to do it, it can be really tough. We know that cooperating with people is stressful sometimes, particularly if you don't like them. You have to exist in a hierarchy, which means that, you know, you are, as an individual, probably costing yourself something by being in this hierarchy, particularly if you're in the middle or down the bottom, which means you get access to things at a much slower rate than the people at the top, for example. You know, you have to coordinate your day with people where ideally you might actually, for your own good, need to go and do something else. And also people lie and they cheat and they steal, to be frank. And so you have to spend a lot of time watching out for those people, because those, yes, well, impact your survival negatively. So what evolution came up with was this set of neurochemicals which motivate us and then reward us for making the effort to be cooperative. And there are four of them. Everyone's heard of oxytocin, but it's much more complex than just oxytocin. So there's oxytocin, dopamine, serotonin, and beta endorphin. And they are all in this cocktail that's released at different times, at different stages of a relationship. And they all have a slightly different job to do in the relationship story. And they are the things that make you feel amazing when you're in love. They are the things that addict you to somebody that, and for example, then make it very painful when you split up. And they are also the ones that make it easier, make you more sociable, reward you for being more sociable, so that you will actually make the effort to build those really survival critical relationships.
That's so interesting to look at it, you know, from that level. I talk a lot, you know, with you know, microbiome specialists, for example, about the gut-brain axis and releasing happy chemicals and endorphins and things. But I've never really heard it put into that context before. We'll come on to each of those, because I think each of those four are really interesting. The one that I'd never heard of, and maybe is new to my listeners here too, are beta endorphins. So can you give us an idea of what they do and what they are and why they're important?
Yeah, sure. So beta endorphin is a very ancient chemical, actually. It evolved to be part of your pain killing system in your body. So if you hurt yourself, beta endorphin is what's released. But we also release beta endorphin in lots of other circumstances as well. You know, if you love your exercise, that feeling you get after a really good run or a really good gym session, that sort of euphoria and that slightly addictive element of, you know, wanting to go and do it again, that's beta endorphin. And we release beta endorphin when we laugh, when we sing, when we dance, when we do lots of different things, when we touch in particular. But beta endorphin is the chemical of long-term love. So what makes human relationships very special compared to even those of our closest primate friends is that they last an incredibly long time. They can last decades. And also we have lots of different sorts of relationships. A lot of animals only have what we call reproductively based relationships. So they will have a relationship with their mate and they may have a relationship with their offspring. And that's pretty much it. And they're all based about reproduction and passing those genes on directly. We have lots of platonic relationships, friendships, other family relationships, which aren't underpinned by the sexual relationship. And you need a chemical that will underpin those as well. Now, oxytocin, which underpins a lot of particularly small mammal relationships, is only really released in any great quantity during sex and when we're sort of giving birth or we're breastfeeding or whatever. What we need is a chemical that will underpin those long-term friendships as well. And the other thing about oxytocin is it's very short-lived. It's not capable of underpinning a relationship for decades because we become immune to it.
Really?
Okay, so it's not terribly helpful, yeah.
Gosh, so that kind of early passion then that you might get in the beginning of a new relationship, is that being driven by oxytocin, but the reason that it diminishes and wear off is because you can't sustain it?
Yeah, so that's being driven very much by oxytocin and dopamine, yeah. Those are the chemicals that are really key at the start of a relationship. But when the relationship starts to mature and it starts to become much, much deeper, and we start to build an attachment to somebody, then beta endorphin steps in, because beta endorphin is an opiate. It's addictive. It's like heroin or morphine. And that's how it underpins long-term relationships. It does it by addicting you to being with that person.
Really?
And when you go away from that person, you go into cold turkey like you would if you were a heroin addict. And then you're drawn back to the source of that wonderful opiate high. So it's a very simple mechanism, actually. Mm. But the wonderful thing about beta endorphin is we do not grow tolerant to it. So it will always be able to underpin it. And because it's released by lots of different activities beyond sex, like, you know, laughing and chatting and touching and, you know, dancing and all these things, it can underpin all those platonic relationships we have. You know, so you go to a comedy club with your friends and have a good old laugh, and that's yeah. helping you bond. So it's a really, really powerful chemical. I think we get fixated on oxytocin, partly because it's very easy to study. Beta endorphin is very hard to study. And secondly, because a lot of the early studies of love were done on little furry rodents. And little furry rodents are great, but they're not actually a good parallel for the human brain. So we needed to look elsewhere. And in fact, we found beta endorphin in our closest primate relatives. And we found through studies at Oxford that it definitely is beta endorphin that is the chemical of long-term love.
How absolutely fascinating. So we've touched there on oxytocin. What about things like serotonin? Where does that come in?
Serotonin's a really interesting one, actually. And serotonin, we're still studying serotonin because it's a bit of a tricky one. Because what's interesting about serotonin is when you fall in love with somebody, oxytocin and dopamine go up in your system. And we can talk a little bit later about what they're doing. But serotonin goes down, which is kind of counterintuitive because we see serotonin as kind of a happy chemical.
Mm.
And it's like, well, that's a bit weird. You know, you should be happy at the start of a relationship. But this is actually not the role for serotonin in this love cocktail. The role for serotonin is in obsessive love. So you have to be vaguely obsessed with the person you're in love with to bother to coordinate your time with them, to be bothered to ask them how they are. Because all of these things take energy, they take time, they take brain power.
Mm.
And the reason why we identify serotonin in this role is because people with obsessive compulsive disorder have very low circulating serotonin. So low levels seem to feed obsession. And as I said, we know you don't want extreme obsession in a relationship, obviously,
yes.
because that's not healthy. But you do need a little bit of it. And it explains, for example, when you're in the start of a relationship, why you might daydream constantly about your new partner. Or, you know, when you've had a baby, you spend your whole time staring at photos of them or looking at their little toes or whatever it might be. And you probably bore your friends a little bit with how much you talk about your new baby.
That's
serotonin.
That's serotonin. Oh, that's
and
so
it's really key at the start.
I love that. And I love the fact that it's key. You know, when I first got together with my boyfriend, I remember actually doing exactly that, boring my friends and my family to death with endless photographs on my phone and like text messaging going, oh, look, isn't he great? You know, and, you know, everyone yawning. And, you know, there was actually a biochemical, neurological reason why I was doing that and why that was important to cement the early relationship.
Absolutely, because if you think in the early relationship, you have to learn so much about this new person. You have to focus so much upon them. And serotonin is going to help you, along with the other chemicals, to do that, to make sure that you take in all this information and you give that new relationship time and focus.
Mm.
And that's what serotonin is doing.
Brilliant. What about dopamine then? What's that doing?
Okay. Well, dopamine we can't really talk about without its little pal oxytocin, I'm afraid. So oxytocin and dopamine actually work together. They tend to do things together when it comes to relationships. So at the start of a relationship, what oxytocin does is it lowers your inhibitions to being sociable. And it does that by quietening the fear center of your brain, which is known as the amygdala. So you imagine you see someone across a bar, you clap eyes on them, you think, wow, you're rather gorgeous. And what happens in your brain is oxytocin's released. And oxytocin quietens that fear center. It relaxes you. It makes you feel a little bit more chilled. So, you know, that nagging voice in the back of your head that saps your confidence about the fact that you're going to walk across the bar and they're going to reject you in front of everybody and it's going to be horribly humiliating. That's quietened down.
So it kind of emboldens you.
To make that move, perhaps. Exactly. Yeah, perfect. An emboldening chemical, basically. At the same time as oxytocin is released, dopamine is released. And dopamine is your hormone of motivation. As well as being a reward, makes you feel nice, it's also your hormone of motivation. And it's needed because with oxytocin, you might be so chilled if it was on its own that you actually don't make any effort to get off the bar stool and go and talk to the person because you're having a lovely time on your own. So dopamine is the one that's going to give you a little bit of a kick and say, no, get off the bar stool and go and make an effort, please. And so that's what dopamine is doing. And then together at those very nanosecond, early moments, It's also working to make your brain more plastic, and particularly in areas of the brain related to learning and memory. Because when you meet someone for the first time, you have to quickly encode, learn a lot of information about them, their name, what they sound like, what they look like, what their interests are, all these sorts of things. And dopamine and oxytocin make that much easier for your brain to do, and much easier for you then to encode that into your memory so it's there to easily retrieve the next time you meet them. Basically.
Gosh, that is absolutely fascinating. And presumably, are these controlled or determined genetically? You know, we talk a lot about epigenetics on this show, particularly in terms of things like weight loss and chronic illness and that kind of thing. Do we have certain gene expressions then that will basically determine how we're going to fall in love and how we're going to sustain our relationships?
As with all genetics, it's not deterministic. So there's always a gene-environment interaction, and some genes have more of an interaction than others. But certainly, love is quite strongly underpinned by a set of genes that's associated actually with those neurochemicals. So one of them is the oxytocin receptor gene, and that has 26-point mutations on it, which vary between individuals and do definitely influence things like how likely you are to want to be in a relationship, for example, how motivated you are to be in a relationship, how happy you'll be when you're in the relationship, how good you are at maintaining the relationship. So things like, you know, intimate disclosure, vulnerability, how good you are at romantic words, romantic talking, and also things like, it can influence things like your attachment style, which 10 years ago, we thought attachment style was entirely environmental, but actually there is an aspect of it that is under genetic control. So certainly some of the way you behave and how you feel will be down to your genes, but it is heavily influenced, particularly in terms of things like attachment, by the environment, particularly the one in which you developed. So it's complicated, but we did a really big study at Oxford looking at the genetic determinants of love, and all sorts of love. So not just romantic love, but friendship love, family love, community love. And certainly there are genes that influence how people behave.
Fascinating. Well, let's pause here. When we come back, I really want to talk about how we love and how that changes as we age. And particularly, let's dig into those attachment styles and also whether it's really possible perhaps to die of a broken heart.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Well, In your book, Anna, you discuss a 2010 study by psychologist Julianne Holt-Lundstedt that concluded that being within a supportive social network, you know, reduced our risk of mortality by 50%, by half. And I think there are so many more conversations now about how stress, you know, something that we might think of as emotional or psychological, has a real effect on our physical bodies. You know, do we need to be thinking about love and relationships in the same way?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we can now say, because that's obviously 2010, 14 years ago. Since then, there have been many, many studies that have replicated those results and strengthened those results. And I think we can now say absolutely fundamentally that the most important aspect of your mental and physical health, your well-being, your longevity is the relationships you create with other people. Because they are, as you said, 50%. That is sort of tallying alongside quitting smoking. And it's much, much stronger, for example, than maintaining a healthy weight. Wow. So it's actually, in a way, the missing health phenomenon.
Yes.
Because we take our relationships for granted. You know, we do all those things which you're told to be healthy, like, you know, drink lots of water, eat the right food, exercise, all those sorts of things. But nobody actually says, do you know what? Just go out and have a lovely cup of tea with a friend.
Yeah.
And actually, that is incredibly powerful. And we are still unraveling why. Mm-hmm. There are various suggestions. Some of them are behavioral. So, for example, if you're in a supportive social network, you are more likely to get practical and emotional help, for example. So if you get yourself in a sticky situation, if you're poorly, for example, or if you're stressed, there's more likely to be people there who will take some of that burden or who will care for you while you're sick.
Yeah.
It might be that, again, if you've got people around you and you have to adhere, for example, to a particular health regime, they might help you stay on the straight and narrow and therefore maintain your health. But also, there are two things going on, we think, biologically as well. One is that we think beta endorphin underpins your immune system as well. So when beta endorphin is released, it kind of ramps up your white blood cell count and it ramps up those immune cells that are going to help fight disease. And the second thing is that when all those lovely chemicals are released, our stress levels are reduced. So if you release oxytocin, dopamine, beta endorphin, serotonin, they actually counteract cortisol, which we all know is the stress hormone. So the two cannot coexist.
Really?
So one of the best ways to de-stress is to be with a group of people who you love
amazing.
And who support you. When you look at the way humans have evolved, it's actually like a no-brainer. You're like, well, of course. But
yes.
I think we've kind of sidelined it a bit. And the other thing to say, the reason why we've kind of arrived at this as well, and it's in the title of my book, that love is a need. Love is actually not an emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Love is a survival critical need. And it sits alongside those other survival critical needs, such as food, water, and shelter. So if you don't have love in your life, then you will definitely experience detriment. You will, for example, if we look at a baby that doesn't receive love, for a starter,
yes.
Hatch, she has a much higher risk of not surviving.
Yes,
but even
for sure.
if it survives, yeah. in terms of things like brain development, it is already on unfortunately, a negative track in life. So it's actually absolutely fundamental to your development, to your health, to your mental health, your longevity, your well-being, and just your life satisfaction. And as I said, for those of us who study evolution, it's kind of a no-brainer, but it's something I think that hasn't come to light publicly enough yet.
Well, I think we definitely need to get you in a position of power here. You need to be joining Sage and Cobra, and so that, you know, when they hit us with the next thing, you can be saying, look, guys, we're not locking down. We're actually all going to get out and have a large party and we're going to hug as many people as we can
improve
our immune
exactly.
system.
Exactly.
About hugging, you know, I have read that, you know, I don't know how many it is. Is it some people say 3 hugs a day, some people 8 hugs a day? It, you know, the actual act of hugging, is this why it's so important then? Because it's having an impact on the beta endorphins, which are influencing and supporting our immune system.
Yes, absolutely. And touch is the most important generator of social neurochemicals. If
Amazing.
You want a really big ramped up effect, touch someone. So that's why hugging's so important. And it's, you know, I mean, these studies that say you need 3, you need 8, they're kind of, but it's the quality of the hug and it's the person
yes.
you do the hug with, okay?
Yeah.
So it's got to be someone that, you know, you are attached to, that, you know, you do love, that doesn't cause you stress.
Yes.
It's a good
yes.
quality hug, but certainly, mm-hmm. and touch is really, really critical. You know, in my other area of study, you know, I study parents and children, and that's why when a baby's born, skin-to-skin contact is the most important thing, because touch is the first sense that we have that is really heightened. And it's the one that does release the most love chemicals.
And then for those listening who may be living on their own, have, you know, touching pets, stroking and hugging, you know, can have a similar effect. It doesn't always have to be human, does it?
Absolutely, no. And again, that's why I wrote the book, because I think we focus very much, first of all, we have a bit of an obsession with romantic love.
Yeah.
Then we have a bit of obsession with human to human love. But actually, no, pet love is just as important. All you need is someone in your life that you love and returns that love. And if that's a dog, if that's a cat, you know, if it's a, I don't know, pet bird, whatever it might be.
I was very fond of my gerbil, I have to say. But he wasn't very good at hugging. But I did love him.
No.
And I was very sad when he
exactly.
died.
And we do experience love. You know, we've done fMRI studies on dog owners and all these sorts of things. And it is love. And so it doesn't matter what you love. As long as it's a healthy love and you can involve touch, go for it. That's great.
So coming back to the romantic love then, this idea of dying of a broken heart, presumably when the person that you love and that you're used to touching and being with is no longer with us in this world, you know, could that then be scientifically possible?
It is scientifically possible. In the first 6 months, for example, after a romantic partner has died, particularly if you're older, you have a much increased chance of dying yourself. And I think we all anecdotally know of these stories. And it can be for a biological reason. So somebody dying causes increased stress on the body, and it causes increased stress, particularly on the circulatory system and the heart. So you do actually have an increased chance of dying, for example, of a heart attack during that period. Also, when somebody dies or when somebody, for example, leaves you, you go into massive chemical withdrawal. And because beta endorphin is also underpins your pain system, suddenly that high level of painkiller that's been circulating in your system disappears. And suddenly all the little aches and pains that it's been covering because you've been in a relationship suddenly come to the fore. And that's why it can be actually physically painful for somebody to leave you or for someone to die, because you suddenly have gone from this lovely high level to literally rock bottom and gone into opiate withdrawal.
And you actually do get that physical pain, don't you? People, you know, say,
you do.
I can't bear it. I hurt so much. And, you know, it's the emotional hurt,
and
the trauma.
Everything
physically.
Yeah.
How interesting that there's an actual biochemical reason why that is happening in our bodies.
Absolutely. And then obviously you have psychological pain, because when we are with somebody, whether it's romantic or not, we take them into our identity. So part of our identity is the fact we have a relationship with that other person. And we might define ourselves with a word, you know, wife, girlfriend, you know, mother, daughter, whatever it might be. And when that person goes, part of your identity goes. And that's really hard to deal with, because suddenly you have to rejig who you are. And that's hard. And it's not just something you necessarily consciously do, but your brain has to work that out as, okay, who am I now? Because this person has gone, and now I'm a different person too. And so it's when someone leaves you or when someone dies, it's highly complex. It's a complex mix of the psychological and the biological coming together to make it, you know, a really physically and psychologically painful situation.
I guess that leads me on to talking about attachment and being attached to people. Mm. And, you know, people listening to this now might be aware of some of the different attachment styles. Certainly if you've looked at relationships or looked at psychology or talked to relationship counsellors, there seem to be different styles of attachment, don't there? Whether they're sort of avoidant or super attached, or I can't remember all the different terms. Can you talk us through what those styles are and see, you know, which ones we might perhaps identify with and which are perhaps positive, which maybe might be slightly more negative maybe in terms of our relationship? And ability to love?
Okay, so there are different sort of, attachment gets complicated because there are different measures depending upon which relationship you're in.
Right.
So let's talk about romantic relationships. So there are four attachment styles in romantic relationships. There's secure, there's preoccupied, there's fearful avoidant, and there's dismissing avoidant. And the way we categorize people is based upon where they sit on two dimensions. The first is, how anxious are they about being left in that relationship? And the second is, how comfortable are they with proximity to that person? So if we look at a secure person, they are high in proximity, so they're very comfortable in proximity, but they're very low in anxiety, so they don't spend a lot of time worrying that the person's going to leave them. And so the secure person, in a way, some people might say is like the pinnacle of attachment, is to be secure. Because you are very comfortable in a relationship, you are happy to be supported in that relationship and be supporting back, but you don't need that relationship to define you, nor indeed to enable you to function. So you are a very secure person.
And is that because you've come from a secure family background, perhaps? Your parents have always been there to support you?
Generally, it is. Your attachment style isn't actually fixed. So you can actually change your attachment style. So I'll say to you, when I first met my partner, my husband, I was preoccupied, which meant I was highly anxious about being left. And that's because my upbringing wasn't that great. Mm-hmm. I am now secure. And that's because my husband, over the God knows how many decades we've been together, has shown me that he's not going to leave me. And so I have shifted. So you can shift. But yes, generally, if you are a secure person, it's generally because you were securely attached to your parents or your carers as a child.
So conversely, then, the opposite might be true, that if you're avoidant or preoccupied, it's because you haven't had that at home.
Yes. So if you are children who are in insecure attachments, either anxious or disorganized, which is one of the ones we use for children, or ambivalent, then they are more likely to be one of the more anxious or dismissing attachment styles when they're older. So if we look at preoccupied people are high in proximity seeking. So they like to be close to people, but they're high in anxiety. So they worry a lot that that person's going to leave them. And the way they deal with that is by maintaining proximity, because by being with that person, you know, we might call them clingy, that person cannot stray because I've got my eye on you the entire time. Okay. So they're preoccupied.
Yeah.
And then we have the two avoidant styles. So there's a fearful avoidant, and like preoccupied, they are very anxious about being left. But the way they deal with it is by avoiding proximity, avoiding intimacy, because if they don't have a relationship, they can't get hurt. So they avoid it. And the last category is dismissing avoidant. And dismissing avoidant people are low in anxiety and low in proximity. And we kind of see these people as the island. They're the sorts of people who don't really need or necessarily want a relationship. They don't avoid them because they're anxious about it. They're just not that fussed, really.
Right.
I will say the dismissing avoidant category is the one with the lowest number of people in it. Most people do want a relationship. And even dismissing avoidant people will end up in relationships, but they can be quite a tricky customer to be in a relationship with, I would say.
Fascinating. And I'm fascinated, you know, when you meet people or when you fall in love, perhaps for the first time, or you're coming out of a relationship and you find a new person. I was talking to somebody the other day who was talking about how he felt when he met his wife, and he, you know, used the expression, you know, it was a coup de foudre. It was literally our eyes met across the crowded room and that was it. You know, we just knew. What would have been going on in the brain then? I mean, is there something kind of, I don't know, it's almost kind of spellbinding and magical, and can that ever be created? Because it just sounds amazing.
I mean, I will put a dampener on things by saying love at first sight doesn't exist, and we can talk about it a little bit later. But certainly, you can certainly, that massive whoosh of wow, feeling amazing, chemicals, everything. So what happens in your brain when you see someone you are attracted to is the reason why you feel like that is there's an algorithm in your brain which assesses lots of different sensory inputs from that person. So it'll be what they look like, what they sound like, how they move, if you're close enough, how they smell, all these different things. And it will put that algorithm together. It's very complicated. And it will work out whether this person is a good person for you. And the reason why I say that is we all have a thing called a biological market value on our heads. And that biological market value is based upon how likely you are to be reproductively successful, i.e. how likely you are to have kids and pass those genes down, because that's all really evolution cares about. And the relationships that work best is when you are with someone of similar biological market value to yourself. And so your algorithm in your head takes all this sensory information in, takes into account a few other things like, am I looking for a short-term relationship or a long-term relationship? Because depending on which one you're looking for, it's slightly different what you will look for in a partner. If it fits nicely with your biological market value, then it'll go ping, lovely. Lots of oxytocin and dopamine will be released in a particular area of the brain called the nucleus accumbens. You'll become amazingly confident. You'll suddenly feel terribly motivated. You'll feel euphoric because you've had a lovely hit of dopamine, and you'll go across the bar and say hello. So that is what was happening in that person's head.
It sounds a bit like a slot machine.
It was obviously ping.
Yes.
Yeah, it is. It's a little bit like your number comes up.
All the cherries come up in a line and that's it.
Yeah,
it all fits together. And interestingly that you talk about things like smell. And in your book, you describe a number of different studies. You know, there's the T-shirt test where, you know, guys have worn T-shirts and then women were asked to identify their, you know, the most likely fit. And that's down to a genetic predisposition, which is then secreted through the sweat onto the T-shirt. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating that all these things are happening in a blink of an eye without us consciously being aware that our brains are processing, going, yeah, this pheromone is right. This chemical means that this person has this particular attribute inside their bodies, within them, that's invisible, but we sense it and we think that they're a good fit, so we're going to go for it.
Absolutely. And what you've got to remember is we've evolved, all the other mammals, particularly the lesser mammals, are highly sensory creatures. They get all their information from their senses. Now, what we've done is we've still got that ability, but on top of that, we have a massive neocortex that does lots of thinking as well. So we actually have a conscious element of love as well. But that sensory bit is still there. It hasn't disappeared. It's just you're just not aware of it, that you're doing it. So you're actually, you know, when people talk to me about, you know, algorithms on dating apps and all that sort of thing, I do say to them, you will never build an algorithm as good as your brain, because it's had millions of years of evolution to be really, really good at this. And so, you know, it is taking in so much information. And then, you know, a little bit later when your conscious brain kicks in, then even more information is going to be considered, because then we start consciously thinking about the suitability of this person. So, you know, do they have similar values to me? You know, well, my family like them. Do we have matching cultures? All these sorts of things that you will then also, you know, are my friends going to like them? And you start to think about all these other things consciously. So there's so much information that goes into whether or not somebody is the right person for you.
It's interesting that we do actually have a number of phrases that describe the physical sensations of love, you know, having butterflies in our stomach or feeling lovesick. You know, I was interested to read in your book about the physiological manifestations of jealousy, for example. You know, so are all these feelings then physical? Are they reality? It's not just something in our head.
No, they're completely reality. And the reason why jealousy is very physical is it's jealousy is there to bring your attention to a threat to your relationship. And the idea is that, you know, you can then decide what you're going to do. Are you going to cut your losses? Are you going to increase the investment in your relationship? Are you going to confront the person who is threatening to take away your partner, whatever it might be? And so it feels very physical because we need your attention. And so absolutely, you will feel sick. You will sweat. Your heart will race. You'll feel shaky. You might get a headache. You know, all of these things are there to draw your attention to this survival threatening possibility and the fact that you need to do something about it. So our physical bodies are very involved in our relationships. You know, we literally, as I said at the beginning, every single fiber in your being is involved in your relationships. Every single mechanism in your body is, because they're so important to you. We can't really get this wrong. You've got to try and get it right. And therefore, evolution has seen fit to make sure that everything is attending to that relationship for you.
Completely fascinating. And I guess moving on to a broader look at social connections, so broadening it out from the idea of romantic love into the love of our community. Fascinating to see in your book the diagram about how many people kind of are in our circle, you know, five very close to us, then it spreads to 15 and then closer, you know, as it kind of it spreads out and we get wider. And I was very interested to see that particularly for this audience here, there seems to be an increase for women around the age of 50, so around menopause time, that we actually start to expand our social connections. And is that because perhaps hormonally we're wanting to share information? We might feel that we need a bit more support. We might need to feel that we're not alone in what we're going through. You know, have anthropologists have looked at this from a menopausal perspective?
Absolutely. Yes. So it's really interesting. And that 50 line is particularly fascinating in women, actually. Sort of, the age around menopause. Because what it seems to be is, first of all, women have shed that role of being reproductive. They've probably got their kids off their hands if they've had children. And suddenly what they need out of life and what they want out of life shifts. And for many women, it shifts more towards friendship than, for example, back to their partner. And, you know, not meaning to be a downer, but there is a big increase in divorce instigated by women after the age of 50. Because suddenly you're in this situation where this person you were with was a great partner and you selected them consciously or not, as a parent with you. And suddenly maybe you need something else out of life now because you've lost, you've shed those responsibilities. you know, hormonally, you're not in that place anymore. And therefore, we tend to find that women do tend to start shifting their perspective towards their friends rather than towards their partner or towards a new partner, somebody who's going to meet mm-hmm. different needs that they now have, somebody to grow old with. So it might be somebody who, you know, is more companionate, maybe somebody who you can rely on, who's going to yeah. care for you and you can care for them. Or maybe you've got to this point where you just want a new adventure and therefore yeah. you want a new partner who's willing to, you know, grab a bag and go around the world with you or whatever it might be. And we find that women's yeah. friendships at that point become much, much more important. And for women, very early on at Oxford, we did a study comparing men's and women's friendships and romantic relationships. And what we found is women tend to be, regardless of age, more emotionally intimate with their female best friend than they are with their romantic partner. Women's friends are a special, special group.
In terms of what? Conversation and things that you might share?
In terms of conversation, you are much more likely to reveal something very intimate, something maybe very painful or maybe something very private to your female best friend than you necessarily are to your romantic partner. You're likely to be much more vulnerable in front of them. And that's probably because when I wrote my chapter on friends, I interviewed lots of women about their friendships. And what they always say to me about their friendships is it's a group of women who are just completely there for you, completely unjudgmental. They've seen you in your best times, they've seen you in your worst times, and they're there for you. And you can't necessarily say that about a partner necessarily.
No.
So that it's like there's no strings.
I was really struck by when you wrote in your book about female friendship and about how as women we tend to have our female friends are very often similar in our outlook, maybe in what they do, our connections, our communities, our interests. Whereas when we select a romantic partner, that person may actually be very different because we're looking for somebody to support us in other ways. And,
yes,
you know,
absolutely.
So maybe, you know, maybe having that kind of simpatico relationship with girlfriends is, I guess, understandable because they're in a similar position to us and they're likely perhaps to understand when we open up and not be judgmental or, you know, we can lose some of the fear perhaps around that. Is the same true for guys? Do guys have, you know, good male friends that they can also be kind of intimately open with?
Men are interesting.
Men yeah, they
tend
are.
To not... and they tend to not have, it's quite rare for a man to have a best friend.
Is it?
What men tend to have is they tend to have a group of friends who are kind of loosely attached to each other and they tend to be brought together, for example, by a shared interest. So, I don't know, cars or football or whatever it might be, poetry, whatever it might be. They tend to, and when men get together, they're very unlikely to just sit and chat. They will generally do something. Then they might chat while they're doing it, but they will tend to do something. Whereas women are much more likely to have much more intimate groups and even, you know, meet quite regularly one-on-one with a friend, much more likely to say they have a best friend or a couple of best friends. And for those relationships to be very much based on talk and the sharing of intimate details. So it's very different. And when we look at male best friendships, when you say to a man, what do you get out of your male best friendship? In a way, it is a similar sanctuary for the man, because again, the tensions that can exist in a romantic relationship aren't there. But what they tend to say is they tend to find like a shared sense of humour and a shared ability just to relax and be yourself.
Yeah.
It's slightly different. It's not about sharing intimacy. It's a different way of dealing with friendship.
So to conclude then, you know, in terms of the health and the well-being benefits that we often focus on this particular show, when we're looking at love here, does it really matter what type of love it is? You know, whether it's romantic, familial, maybe even with a god or your spiritual guide or your community, you know, as long as there is that connection and that sense of love, or do you think there are types of love that we should really be definitely aiming to achieve and like tick the boxes to ensure health and well-being?
No, you're absolutely right. It doesn't matter what the sort of love is. So, you know, it doesn't have to be romantic. It doesn't have to be parental. You just have to find someone or something to love in your life. And that's, again, why I wrote the book. So I wanted to say to people, let's just realise it's not a hierarchy. So romantic love is not at the top as the pinnacle of achievement.
Really?
It's just flat. It's horizontal. It's just a spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So pick the love that works for you. And, you know, make sure it's a healthy love. That's the most important thing. Make sure it's mutually supportive and go for it. It really, really doesn't matter. But it is critical to your health that you do have love in your life.
Brilliant. What a great note to end on. Anna, thank you so much and congrats on the book. It's absolutely fascinating, riveting stuff. I'm going to be reading and rereading it. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Anna, what a fascinating look at something we can perhaps take for granted. So thank you so much for your time. Well, has any of this made you think differently about how you prioritise the relationships in your life? Do let me know on Instagram. We are at Lizelle Wellbeing, and I'm on there too, at Lizelle Me. Or I tell you what else you can do. You can email me now to tell me your stories and indeed ask me your questions. So in a few weeks' time, I'm going to be giving you the reins. What do you want to ask me about living a better second half? What do you want to learn more about? What are you intrigued to implement in your own life? Well, you can now email podcast@lizellewellbeing.com, and I might just be answering your question on the show very soon. And of course, if you'd like to listen to that and all other episodes ad-free, you can subscribe to the Lizelle Wellbeing Show Plus on Apple Podcasts for a very small monthly fee. And you'll get to listen to all future episodes 24 hours before everyone else too. While I've got you here, I would also love to tell you about the new book that I have written. You may have guessed, it is called A Better Second Half, and it has been a real labour of love, taken several years, and is the culmination really of many, many decades of my own personal experience of well-being, what works, what doesn't, health hacks, especially for midlife women, midlife and beyond, how to have a truly better second half. Mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually, so many things I cover. I really can't wait. Now, if you'd like to pre-order, it is up on Amazon now, pre-order. Get your order in early because it will be released at the end of April. Or, of course, you can pre-order from your local bookseller. Always a good idea to support the local book trade. Anyway, until the next time we chat, go well. Goodbye. The Lizelle Wellbeing Show is presented by me, Lizelle, and is produced by Anushka Tate for Fresh Air Production, with additional production support from Ellie Smith.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.